Did you think you were God, Brandon?
You don't love me. I'm just something you caught. You think I'm some kind of animal you've trapped.
That's right, you are.
Did you ever try to keep warm on a C-54 at 15,000 feet, 20 degrees below zero?
Oh, I do it all the time.
It's not good to find out too much, Charlie.
But we're sort of like twins, don't you see? We have to know.
Oh, we have 12 vacancies. 12 cabins, 12 vacancies.
Not that I mind a slight case of abduction now and then, but I have tickets for the theater this evening. And I get, well, kind of unreasonable about things like that.
Well, it's a cinch. Here, I look up, I look down. I look up, I look down.
You know, I've got a theory that you should do everything before you die.
Welcome back to Talking Hitchcock. And today, it's just me in the screening room. And I'm delighted and excited to introduce you to Hitch Takes, a new series which I see as a complimentary offshoot to the main podcast. These episodes are designed to be received as a collection of thoughts, responses, and theories on Hitchcock's films and the topics surrounding them. I'll be sharing my thoughts with you in part conversational, part essay style. And as with the main podcast, I consider this to be a journey for listeners and for myself. And as such, I want to acknowledge that I consider myself a student of Hitchcock. And this is an ongoing process that, as far as I'm concerned, will never be finished. We all interpret and respond to art in individual and personal ways that reflect the uniqueness of the art itself. In this respect, I'm very aware that my perspective on Hitchcock is nothing but a speck of dust in a universe of thought, criticism, and personal opinion. My aim in sharing this is to engage with others, to dissect, to discuss, and to reevaluate. My hope and intention with Hitch Takes is that these act as conversation starters to facilitate further thought and discussion, as well as being a way for me to share and exchange the multitude of bubbling questions and ponderances I have about Hitchcock. So, with that being said, I invite you to settle in, adjust your dial to curiosity, and join me for the very first Hitch Take. Today's subject began with a revisit of Vertigo, as I was preparing to write about it for its 65th anniversary. There were many, many ideas, and the one I landed on became an editorial for Fangoria, exploring the numerous ways in which Vertigo can be read as a possession film. But to return to the ideas that didn't make the cut, I was thinking about sexuality and impotence, and I'd observed how Scotty begins the film flaccid, a dangling phallus as he grasps onto the edge of a building, and concludes it fully erect, stood upright on the bell tower at San Juan Bautista. I'd also given thought to the contrasting vaginal spaces of the film, from the multiple corridors and graves to the empty blackness at the centre of many of its spirals. It was from the foundation of the role and the presence of the phallus in Vertigo that I then began to think more closely about Midge, an avenue, or should that be corridor, that I was surprised to find myself walking down. And it is here that I open on my exploration of Midge in a take I'm calling Curious Mother or Interested Lover. Naturally, there will be deviations from the main topic. When it comes to Vertigo, there's no restraint to be had, and nor should there be. But primarily, what I'd like to discuss today is the character of Midge and ways of interpreting her. At this point, if you've not seen Vertigo, I encourage you wholeheartedly to watch an absolute masterpiece and run the risk of developing, as I have, a lifelong obsession, as there will be spoilers in this podcast. To begin then, let's consider what we know about Midge, played with such devotion, Realness and Tenderness by Barbara Bel Geddes. Midge lives in a San Francisco apartment. She is an artist working in the field of commercial design. In this sense, it's interesting to think about Midge as being an artist connected to the world of art, given the film's preoccupation with creating and constructing. Midge has also briefly been engaged for 3 weeks to Scotty, her one-time college friend who she's known for many years, played by Jimmy Stewart. Across a film that lasts a little over 2 hours, Midge is included in only a handful of scenes, and once Scotty is hospitalised, she is never seen again. I'd like to examine these scenes and then consider some broader points as well as posing some questions for further thought and analysis.
How's your love life, Midge?
It's following a train of thought.
Well?
Normal.
Aren't you ever going to get married?
You know there's only one man in the world for me, Johnny O.
You mean me? We were engaged once, though, weren't we?
3 whole weeks.
Yeah, good old college days. But you were the one that called off the engagement, you remember? I'm still available.
The first scene with Midge comes right after the opening, where we've already seen Scotty, a now retired but at the time employed police detective, running atop the skyline of San Francisco. In actual fact, when I said earlier that the film opens and concludes with a flaccid and erect Scotty, that wasn't quite true. For, in what one may call the prelude, we see him upright, involved in a chase, fully engaged as he shoots his gun, an action mirroring ejaculation. Here, with a gun amidst the heights of the city, he is vital and full of power and freedom, words that we hear repeated throughout the film. Soon, however, we see him slip and he's forced to watch his colleague plummet to his death. Scotty is left clinging on for dear life, and it is Scotty clinging on that is the last image we see of him before we enter Midge's apartment. Food for thought, indeed. Film critic Robin Wood has written of how, upon arriving at Midge's apartment, we do not see and are never told how he got down from the gutter. There seems no possible way he could have got down. The effect is of having him throughout the film, metaphorically suspended over an abyss. I'd like to add another potential theory. Given that Midge's apartment is above street level, this gives the impression that, arriving when he does, Scotty has fallen from the rooftop into Midge's apartment, before we then see him hitting the ground to follow Madeline, and even at one point finding himself almost below ground, approaching a grave during the dream sequence. This seems to speak to the idea of a Scotty who is in fact falling throughout the film. There are also further assertions that post-opening sequence, everything that occurs represents some kind of dream or fantasy. If this is indeed true, then each scene featuring Midge, which are normally remarked upon as anchoring the film in reality, deserve some close re-evaluation, as they too represent a kind of fantasy on Scotty's behalf then. If Scotty's experiences in Vertigo are representative of a mere dream, what does this convey of his feelings for Midge? Having now witnessed a man fall to his death, Scotty is contending with the fear of becoming flaccid again, but he is unable, at least with Midge, to remain fully upright. Note his use of the cane to support him in this scene, something we never see him use when with Madeline or when with Judy. Here, Scotty is like a man-child at play with his phallic cane, while his mother, Midge, is busy at work. Tomorrow he will be free, he tells her, and when she asks what he's going to do, he remarks upon how she sounds so disapproving, mirroring the idea of a child feeling that they have disappointed their mother. There are moments when both are sat down, but Scotty is seen lounging on a recliner chair and then again laying on a couch, presenting a combination of him feeling restless, whilst this scene also acts as some kind of therapeutic confessional. However, by contrast, Scotty too is up and down a lot, suggesting an interest or at least a desire for Midge, but an inability to maintain this uprightness before he returns to his seat again, to flaccidness, and of course, to restlessness. This links to his acrophobia in the first instance, but could there also be an undercurrent of referring to sexual impotence and desire? Although it is clear that there's been a romantic charge between them in the past, certainly on Midge's behalf, as a tight shot of her face reveals when they discuss their short-lived relationship, we also see and hear her educate him about women's underwear. A conversation that has the potential to be sexy, but just doesn't hit those kind of notes. Instead, she occupies the mother role, both in her costume and in her overall manner in her persistent questions over his health and future, such as, have you had any dizzy spells this week? And what do you plan to do now? When Scotty asks her when she is going to settle down, she remarks, there's only one man in the world for me, indicating Scotty, of course. But as we hear that she, in fact, called their relationship off after only 3 weeks, perhaps the only man for Midge is a man of the past, who, in the present, can no longer meet her needs. If Midge is motherly, then, it's important to note that this does not mean to be without control. On the contrary, this is perhaps what Scotty fears most in terms of any kind of long-term relationship with Midge. One look at the figures in Hitchcock's Gallery of Mothers will tell us that these are not passive women. Instead, they hold and exercise great power over their sons and daughters. Although it feels unfair and quite frankly impossible to read Midge as a repressive force, for Scotty, her independence and self-sufficiency, like that of Lisa Fremont in Rear Window, threatens him. In linking back to the motherliness too, perhaps in knowing Scotty, Midge represents a familiarity that Scotty wishes to escape.
What's this doohickey?
It's a brassiere. You know about those things. You're a big boy now.
I've never run across one like that.
It's brand new. Revolutionary uplift. No shoulder straps and no back straps, but does everything a brassiere should do. Works on the principle of the cantilever bridge.
Does?
Mm-hmm. An aircraft engineer down the peninsula designed it. He worked it out in his spare time.
Kind of a hobby.
This sense of motherliness and romanticism seem to collapse in the use of their language, as Midge's role as mother figure almost seems to be part of a flirtation between them too. You know about such things. You're a big boy now, lends an awkwardness that is neither wholly platonic nor wholly sexual. It is, like Midge's later insertion of herself into the portrait of Carlotta Valdez, alienating and strange. On the other hand, there's a strong argument for reading Midge as, like Lisa Fremont, a woman who enjoys and is very successful in her work. She declines Scotty's invite for a date to continue her designs. She is very much a modern woman. It is to her job she is married, not to a man. There is an interesting through line from the opening scene to their visit later to see Pop Liebel, the local history expert and owner of the Argosy bookstore. At Midge's apartment, Scotty mentions his corset in which he is restrained, suggestive of a feeling of being reined in by Midge, or at least of a future with Midge. Between this scene and their visit to see Pop, Scotty becomes entranced by Madeline, essentially wandering off from his motherly former beau. To put it another way, the corset comes off. After their visit to the bookstore, where they hear about the history of Carlotta, Midge threatens to put Scotty back in the corset. it reads as more of a disarming joke than an act of promise. But does this not also seem to signal towards a mother threatening his sexually deviant son with matriarchal control?
Well, it's a cinch. Here, I look up, I look down. I look up, I look down.
In the final moments of this scene in Midge's apartment, Scotty discloses how he has devised a plan to incrementally get used to heights again, choosing to begin with a small stool. He's able to reach the top of this, and it represents a comfortable level for him. But Midge fetches another stool, urging him to go on, encouraging him to take step number two, whilst looking wry and expectant. Ascending further, he becomes overtaken by fear before falling into her arms. In short, although he is unable to reach beyond a certain height, gripped by his acrophobia, this scene may also denote that he is not able to maintain an erection whilst in Midge's presence. When he falls into her arms, it's not a romantic embrace, but one of desperation, longing for security, for reassurance, like that a son may crave from his mother. In working through his fear via a kind of exposure therapy exercise, coupled with his time revealing what's happened so far to her on the couch, this points towards some interesting readings of Midge as a therapist figure that are certainly worth closer inspection. After some wondering, Scotty finds himself back in Midge's apartment, looking for advice and knowledge. And Midge is certainly a woman in the know. It's interesting that while she gives off a very contemporary aura, her connection to pop and his stories of the gay old bohemian days also ties her to the past. Ever in pursuit of knowledge and keen to deliver Scotty what he desires, she dashes out of the apartment before he can even finish his drink. As they listen to the wise and worldly pop provide details of Carlotta's life, it's striking to observe their responses and how there seem to be elements of both of them present in the tale of Carlotta. Midge being the sad Carlotta who lives alone in the great house, or apartment rather, as evoked through her emotive and expressive eyes, and we even see her stare a little when Pop mentions the word sad. And Scotty, who actually turns around and looks at Pop as the word mad is mentioned. He is the mad Carlotta then, walking the streets of San Francisco, searching. This loneliness extends to both of them, in fact, as although Midge clearly has a friendly relationship with Pop, he feels like more of an acquaintance than a friend. And like Scotty too, we never see Midge with friends or family. When Pop finishes his story, the two have the brief aforementioned interaction outside his store. "Pay me," she asks teasingly. "You'll tell or I'll have you back in that corset." Although it's clear that Midge is requesting information here, the sexual undertones are more than obvious, and again occupy an undefined space in having kinky possibilities that relate to sexual desire, and a motherly restrictiveness, a warning that if information is not shared with mother, the reins will be made shorter and tighter, an action that, in and of itself, also carries fetishistic connotations.
What do you think?
Well,
is she pretty?
Carlotta?
No, not Carlotta, Elster's wife.
Yes, I guess you'd consider that she would
be I think called. I'll go take a look at that portrait.
No,
goodbye.
Midge.
Goodbye.
Midge, you...
In the car ride home, she probes him again for details. But in actual fact, just as a mother often knows, she does not need this information from him as she summarises the situation in one neat sentence. The idea is the beautiful Carlotta has come back from the dead and taken possession of Elster's wife, she notes. When she asks him what he thinks of Madeline, he stutters, attempting to deviate. But perhaps the truth is that he cannot tell her what he really thinks, because A, if we read Midge as a love interest, then this represents a romantic betrayal, and B, if we read Midge as a purely motherly figure, it also signifies the loss a mother feels when her son enters into a romantic relationship, along with, of course, the awkwardness a son may feel in talking about matters of sex and desire. Note, he tells her to get out of the car, like an embarrassed child evacuating his parent from the room. In asking questions such as, is she pretty? And declaring that she plans to go and take a look at the painting of Carlotta, which has become entwined with Scotty's obsession of Madeline, Midge is positioned as both the curious mother, vetting her child's potential partner, and the interested ex-lover, who now realises she has competition. She also laughs when he shares that Madeline might be possessed by Carlotta, like a mother disregarding her over-imaginative child. Despite them being close, there is a distance at play here too. As this exchange takes place, sandwiched between and behind them is the San Francisco Bridge, acting as a literal dividing obstacle in their relationship, representing that there's something between them, but that despite their failure to connect, Midge is also continuing to try to reach him.
Well now, Johnny-o, was it a ghost? Was it fun?
There is one occasion where we see Midge driving past Scotty's apartment. To see him, or just in passing, it's kept wonderfully ambiguous. And she happens to see Madeline leave. Whilst Midge is shown seeing Madeline, the latter is never made aware of the former. There is, in this scene, a sadness again in Midge, her eyes representing an acknowledgement of a loss, of a lack. It goes without saying that if Midge has purposely driven by Scotty's apartment, especially given her placement behind the wheel of a car, she mirrors the position of Scotty earlier throughout his trailing of Madeline, an eerie and much under-discussed repetition. Just as Midge is unacknowledged by Madeline, so too is she unacknowledged by Scotty, who rushes out after his new love interest. This occurrence gives added meaning to Midge's later remark to him of, "You don't even know I'm here, do you?" In driving past and never crossing the threshold of his apartment, we could argue that we never see Midge enter into Scotty's world. It is he who has come and gone to and from her apartment, we remember, while Madeline is able to enter into this world, if only to depart again from it before too long. In North by Northwest, we hear Eve Kendall inquire about what the O in Roger O'Thornhill stands for, to which he replies, "Nothing." It's interesting to me that this O appears 1 year earlier in Vertigo, where we hear Midge refer to Scotty several times as Johnny O. This seems to re-emphasise the idea of voids, abysses and lacks that we see throughout the film. Tanya Medleski, author of The Women Who Knew Too Much, expands on the idea of the O and nothingness in her essay on Vertigo entitled Femininity and Design, noting, "For if woman, who is posited as she whom man must know and possess in order to guarantee his truth and identity, does not exist, then in some important sense, he does not exist either, but rather is faced with the possibility of his own nothingness." The portrait scene may be the most interesting that we see between Midge and Scotty, in that a shift seems to have occurred in both of them, albeit in very different ways. In the first and second scenes at her apartment, Midge does not run and tend to Scotty to the extent she does here. It is only post their conversation about Madeline in the car, where she has rightly detected his true feelings for her, and through her observing Madeline leave his apartment, a fact Scotty remains unaware of, that she now ups her game. When Scotty arrives, she's almost enacting the part of a doting wife, welcoming him back affectionately, offering to fix him a drink. She's playing at homemaker. There are talks of feeding him and going for drinks and a movie, a conventional date which does not match up with how he's been spending his time with Madeline, but that interestingly does align with the forthcoming dates that we see him go on with Judy, involving dinner and dancing, seeking to connect the pair in some way. More of that in just a moment. I read it as important that the scene preceding this is highly romanticised, showing Scotty and Madeline's kiss at Fort Point, which is then followed by a fade to black. This choice denotes a number of things. Firstly, it takes us into the nighttime setting of Midge's apartment, the only time we see her apartment in the evening. Secondly, it represents the walk into nothingness that Scotty will soon undertake, as well as the one that Midge will take out of Scotty's life. Furthermore, once we have watched this scene, it also comes to represent the end of Midge and Scotty's connection. The next time we see them together, Scotty will be catatonic and speechless, his mind having temporarily left his body. It's interesting, I think, too, that while Midge comes across as someone entirely sociable, this is now the third time, of only a handful in total, that we've seen her at home. This links her further to the idea of a Hitchcock mother, in tying her closely with the homestead. It also makes her a grounded and practical character. Unlike Scotty, she is not a wanderer. Again though, this side of her character is juxtaposed with the lover side, this time illustrated through her unusual choice to wear red, a colour repeated throughout the film and which represents desire, passion and eroticism. It's clear that now she demands his attention. She is in lover mode. Scotty takes care to remark of one specific unusual behaviour of Midge's here. "Since when did you start leaving notes under other people's doors?" he asks. An activity that reflects Madeline's early letter posting to Scotty. Something that Midge could never possibly have known about, but that acts as a fascinating mirroring. He calls her note desperate, but she corrects him, saying all she wanted was to see him, although this is an obvious downplaying on her behalf. Just as her demeanour and behaviour towards him have altered somewhat, Scotty too seems to have changed, as he is notably more sombre and less communicative towards her right from the moment of arrival. She asks him what he's been doing and, like many of Midge's words, it feels as though there's a hidden subtext beneath. Here, one perhaps could alter the line to read, "What have you been doing all the time I've been here?" Furthermore, when she tells him that she's returned to her first love, painting, he makes the loaded comment, "I told you you were wasting your time in the underwear department." And thus, in one line, Scotty confirms and seals his opinion of Midge, shattering the hope of any future relationship, and all before she's even had the chance to show off her latest masterpiece.
Johnny.
No, it's not funny, Midge.
Johnny?
No.
Johnny, I just thought...
No. Let's make that movie some other night.
Johnny? Oh, Marjorie, what do you... Fool! Idiot! Stupid, stupid.
In revealing the portrait to him, Midge inserts herself into Scotty's fantasy. She also crosses a boundary, or should that be, a bridge, from which there is no return. The image, which has Carlotta's body, but Midge's face complete with glasses, feels off. It feels uncanny and something doesn't quite fit, as Scotty's reaction to it shows. I wonder about whether this is a reaction to what he perceives as her inauthenticity in this moment, or whether it is about him repressing her power and freedom to fully explore all parts of herself and to try on different identities. This puts me in mind of the treatment of the second Mrs. De Winter in Rebecca, who usually wears tweeds and cardigans, when she purchases a cocktail dress and is subsequently made to feel ridiculous and humiliated by her husband Maxim. Hitchcock gives us an incredible shot of Midge and Midge's Carlotta side by side, but even here, the real-life Midge cannot imitate what she has created, even when she is recreated a woman as herself. As Barbara Straumann observes in her essay Fatal Resemblances, cross-mapping Hitchcock's Vertigo with Nabokov's Lolita, Midge is offering a corrective to Scotty's deluded fantasy by showing him that she knows he's in love with an image rather than a real woman. To add to this, I would note that by putting herself into Scotty's fantasy, she has, as I've already mentioned, ruptured a boundary, but perhaps has also threatened it in some way too, by bringing into question the validity of Scotty's desires. There is no doubt that Midge has felt alienated by Scotty in the past, and here she unintentionally returns that alienation effect, resulting in her alienating herself from him for good.
Oh, Johnny. Johnny, please try. Try, Johnny. You're not lost. Mother's here.
John, oh, you don't even know I'm here, do you? But I'm here.
The final time we see Midge, she is tending to a catatonic, now hospitalised Scotty. All communication has now been lost between them. Unable to reach him, whether it be through enacting the mother role, "You're not lost, mother's here," she coos, or via Mozart, who's clearly not the boy for Scotty. The man who's been slowly fading away from her throughout the film is completely absent, unaware of her presence. And so we get one of the saddest lines in all of Hitchcock. "You don't even know I'm here, do you?" There's still a suggestion of a lingering hope through the eye-catching and romantic bouquet of roses and within Midge herself. But the fact that hope exists when it's clear there's no opportunity for this makes it all the more devastating. Speaking to one of the medical staff asking over Scotty's recovery, we catch a glimpse of a Midge as Madeline, or rather a Midge as Judy playing Madeline. Stood in a doorway wearing grey, Midge's appearance here is juxtaposed with and acts as a foreshadowing of the transformation scene in the Empire Hotel. As she ponders tentatively, with the answer already detectable in her voice, "I've got a feeling Mozart isn't going to help at all." What she may also be saying is, "I've got a feeling that Midge isn't going to help at all." Or even, perhaps, at a stretch, "I've got a feeling that Mother isn't going to help at all." In any case, in her role as curious mother or interested lover, she has lost Scotty forever. Not long after Midge exits Vertigo, Hitchcock introduces us to Judy Barton. An exploration on their differences and similarities has become of particular interest to me. Midge is a knowable, readable, and grounded character. She is real. Madeline represents the opposite, an unknowable, unpredictable illusion. When placing Midge and Judy side by side, though, some interesting crossovers begin to emerge. We witness Midge walk out of the film while Judy walks in, a fact that to me feels indicative of some kind of exchange. But it's much more complicated than a simple switch of empathy and identification. For Midge is someone to whom we're instantly drawn and recognise. She is of our world. And for that reason, she's an excellent and effective foil for Madeline. Judy, on the other hand, arguably does not engender the immediate sense of comfort that we experience with Midge. But moreover, she stirs a deep curiosity in us. Although there are many aspects of Judy that encourage a relatability, she remains, for first-time viewers specifically, an unknowable character, like Madeline. Until, that is, we reach the confession scene. Up to this point, our relationship with Judy is clouded in uncertainty. But once we discover the truth, she transitions to becoming familiar, knowable, like Midge. In becoming the other woman, as Midge was to Madeline, and in her hopeless wish to be liked for me, as Judy says, she desires Scotty's acceptance and attention. There is then a definite mirroring in Judy and Midge. Both women, it should be noted, present adapted versions of themselves for Scotty. Does such a mutation from the self highlight for Scotty duplicity and incompatibility, or is Hitchcock pointing towards themes of reconstruction, showing us and Scotty that any recreation of the ideal image will always remain imperfect? We've already discussed the portrait scene, where Midge sits not only as a portrait for Scotty, but as herself. It's interesting that he asks her if the portrait is still life, for this has potential to signify that for Scotty, a life with Midge is one that does not excite him. There is also, of course, a raw irony in the fact that Midge cannot measure up to what Scotty deems to be the real thing, when in fact what he deems to be real does not exist. When Judy, done up to resemble Madeline, prepares to go for dinner with Scotty, she stood in front of a mirror, a reoccurring motif throughout Vertigo that points towards notions of fragmentation and doubling. In this moment too, she asks him to fix the clasp on her necklace, a development that leads to him realising she's been enacting the role of Madeline all along. In both cases, then, the presentation of Midge and Judy that are shown to Scotty are counterfeit to some degree. They in themselves are unreal and unfamiliar in these circumstances, which adds even further to the irony in that, for Scotty, fantasy has served his desires very well so far. So the big question becomes, why does he reject it in these cases? It's interesting too to consider what Midge and Judy reveal about gender imbalancement and what is needed to form a romantic relationship. As Karen Hollinger remarks in The Look, Narrativity and the Female Spectator in Vertigo, the narrative suggests that in order for a woman to establish a successful relationship with a man in patriarchal society, qualities in direct opposition to Midge's motherly power and independence must be cultivated. Qualities embodied in the image of Madeline, whose physical beauty and mysterious eroticism literally drive Scotty insane. Is there then potential for a reading here that, as the surface level qualities apparent in Madeline are what drives Scotty insane, that Hitchcock is offering a critique of this, a warning of being bound to and led by qualities of beauty and sex? Vertigo's ending, with Scotty stood literally on the precipice of the bell tower after watching Judy fall to her death, is of course a return to the film's opening. As the shot fades to black, we leave Scotty peering into nothingness from a great height. However, while Midge may have been a long time absent from the film, a deleted scene made to appease the film's censors but never used invites her back into the narrative and is therefore worthy of attention. For those who may not have seen it, this final scene, which is completely devoid of dialogue, shows an anxious Midge positioned next to the radio as she hears of Elster's imminent capture, simply waiting like an anxious mother. What could Scotty possibly intend by returning to Midge's apartment? He's already made it quite clear that he does not wish to pursue a romantic relationship. When we remove this possibility from the equation, perhaps all that is left to consider is the idea of the mother figure. In viewing Midge as fulfilling the need for a motherly role in his life, Scotty then is coming home, as it were, for sanctuary, for recuperation, returning to the familiar, to be tended to, but not crucially for romance. Scotty arrives and she makes them both a drink before moving not closer to him but back behind her desk. There's a disquieting tension in the air, but the overriding feeling is one of sadness for the lives and the futures that could have been and which are now destroyed. The absence of speech between the pair acts as a seemingly unstoppable descent into despair. If we assess their scenes together across the film, we can track their gradual separation. To begin with, they share exchanges, each contributing to the conversation. This leads to Midge talking to a silent Scotty in the hospital, before culminating in this moment where both of them remain silent, unable to communicate. Arriving in Midge's apartment after the experience of being on a ledge of a high place is, of course, familiar territory for Scotty, for this is where he first comes after the incident at the beginning of the film. Therefore, there's also the possibility of reading this as him finding himself to be trapped in some kind of nightmare loop. In the final moment, Midge is sat before him, looking up, just as she was during the portrait scene, looking up in wonder at what has happened, and in total bewilderment as to how she can ever try to reach him again. Thank you for joining me for the first Hitch take. It's time to leave the screening room, but don't fret. You can find Talking Hitchcock on Twitter at Hitch_pod and Instagram at Talking Hitchpod. So, if you like what you hear, please consider supporting the podcast by giving us a follow and leaving us a star review. If you enjoyed this, please do tell a friend and help to spread the word. What are your thoughts then on Midge and all I've discussed here today? I'd love to hear from you, and I'd also love to hear if you'd welcome more Hitch Take episodes in the future. And if so, whether there are any specific topics that you'd like to see me explore. If you've anything you'd like to share, you can reach me on talkinghitchpod@gmail.com. You can read my essay, The Past, the Present and the Perverse, Vertigo as a Possession Film, over at fangoria.com, or by visiting the link trees in my bios. You can also read my two-part essay, Constructing and Resurrecting the Ideal Woman, Judy Barton in Vertigo, with Moving Pictures Film Club, as part of my ongoing series, Hitchcock's Women, where you can find more essays on everything from Notorious to North by Northwest. I've been your host, Rebecca, and you can find me and my work on Twitter and Instagram at PendlePumpkin. Thank you so much for being here with me. I look forward to seeing you back in the screening room soon, but until next time, stay curious and keep talking Hitchcock. Thank you.